Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
Thank you, Ian. It was 9:09 now, and I was watching former President Carter's funeral, the arrival of his body in Washington, and the procession to the rotunda and so forth, having been in D.C. over the weekend. And it got me to thinking about, for whatever reason, Dale Earnhardt, when he died, it would seem to me a NASCAR driver, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful here, but that a hearse should move at like 120 miles an hour if you got a NASCAR driver in the back of it. If you got a race car driver, the hearse, the last thing in the world would be disrespectful to go slow. Right, Fiegel in the studio? What do you think? He's saying, yeah, he agrees with me. I don't know what got me to thinking about that, but it did. Greg Upton joins us now, director of LSU Center for Energy Studies. Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. Doing great.
Happy New Year. I got my own rules for that. Haven't spoken to you, so I wish you a happy new year. And while I'm talking about former President Carter, and I hope I don't catch you flat-footed here, but I may or may not be old enough to remember the gas and the oil embargo, whatever it was, and the gas lines and waiting in line, hoping I get enough gas to go on a date in high school. Maybe I'm not. The records are sealed on that until the late 2000s for people to find out my true age, but take me, if you will, the history, Greg, and again, I hope I'm not catching you off guard here. How do we go from gas lines in the 70s, and watching Jimmy Carter's funeral got me thinking about this, how did we go from gas lines in the 70s to the oil boom in the 80s, about which I was having a conversation with somebody over the weekend, and how the Louisiana has not been the same since, and where we are today. Can you do that for us or not?
Yeah, sure. So there's a great book I recommend for your readers who are actually interested in kind of digging into this. It's a book called Crude Volatility by Bob McNally. And that book goes through, like, from the beginning, talking in the early 1900s, the beginning of oil production, and kind of these the history and kind of the politics of how you had these fluctuations and items like you talk about the 1970s. But here's the kind of two-minute version of that.
You can give us a five-minute version.
Okay, that sounds good. So you go back to the first oil and gas well in the United States was drilled in the 1870s, in Pennsylvania, Titusville, Pennsylvania. Moved to the Gulf Coast in the early 1900s. In fact, 1901 is when the first well was drilled here in Louisiana. And we really had this kind of boom of increase in production all the way until about 1970. At that point, oil production started to decline.
Why?
And we kind of entered because of the resource that was there. So there was, you had a lot of production, you had growth. All of kind of the low-hanging fruit, if you will.
The cheap, easy oil. If you don't mind me interrupting for a second, Professor, just so I can understand. The cheap, easy oil that was there, right, was gone. Was that it? Accurate or not?
That's exactly right.
All right.
So production started to decline. And at that time, of course, demand for gasoline and diesel and jet fuel and all these products that we actually use that are derived from the oil continued to expand. And so this increased our reliance on these international sources of oil. And in particular, the relevant one is, of course, the Middle East. So the Middle East was seeing expanding production over that time period, and that expanding production was increasing imports into the United States.
Let me interrupt one second, Greg, if I can. So oil production declines. That means that there is cheap available oil in the Middle East, and now they are better able to, or at least the market in America opens up because now they can produce cheap available oil, relatively so, and the U.S. becomes dependent on that? Am I on anything?
You got it. Okay. That's right. So our production's declining, our demand is increasing, and therefore we are purchasing this oil from other parts of the world, and in particular the Middle East.
Okay, so
of course— when you start importing oil from the Middle East, this can create geopolitical tensions of energy security and all of these kind of tag words that are out there that we discuss. And so when politicians start restricting the import of products or restricting prices of products, that is what leads to these shortages that you saw in the 1970s. And so kind of thankfully, at least from an economist's perspective, we've kind of moved past those kind of policies. And now today we really have this global market for oil and gas that we, you know, we trade oil and gas globally.
Let me go back 1 second. So the oil embargo happens. That was prompted by
the federal government.
No, wait, I mean, from the Middle East. Why do we have that shortage?
Oh, from the, yeah. You're saying back to the 1970s.
Yeah, I'm going back to 70s, yeah.
Yeah, that's correct. So I need to go get the specific history of exactly the...
it was political?
The events that happened there. Absolutely.
Okay, it was political. So OPEC says, you know what, that's it. We're cutting off the spigots. So after that... something leads to the oil boom in Louisiana because it's like, well, from now on, we're not going to be dependent on OPEC anymore. Accurate or not?
No. So we continue to import oil from the Middle East, and we actually do. We still do to this day. And then in the around 2010, so you go from 1970 to 2010, U.S. oil production was declining. And then in 2010, that's when you had the advent of shale.
Wait. Hang on, horizontal drilling. I hate to keep interrupting, but I got to know why did we have the Louisiana oil boom in the 80s? Because I remember living on the West Bank. Man, it was happy days are here again. It was like the gold strike in California almost, right?
Absolutely.
So why did that happen, I guess, what I'm asking? What happened to that, and what caused it to bust? How did we go from what led to the boom of the 80s to the bust after that?
So we had price fluctuations between 1970 and into the late 1970s. Prices went up. This led to a boom in oil production and economic activity. And then in 1982, that's when you had the oil price bust. And that was draconian for the Louisiana economy. That put us in a recession, and that was really, really bad for the Louisiana economy in particular. And then the oil production within the United States just kind of continued to decline after that time period.
I didn't mean to keep interrupting you. I'm just trying to understand. So the market conditions that led to the boom in Louisiana were caused by increased consumption, and it made it, because of higher prices, it was profitable for the oil companies to go back and get the oil that wasn't as easy to get as it was initially?
No. Yeah, so you've got kind of two things going on. You have the longer-term trend, which is, what the availability of the oil is. The other longer-term trend you have going on is technology, and so the sophistication of the companies and how much information they have, what they're able to extract. The shorter term fluctuation you have is the price. And so when the price goes up, holding technology and availability constant, you're going to produce more oil. When the price goes down, you're going to produce less, and that's going to create these kind of business cycle fluctuations that occur. And that is exactly what happened in 1982 when we had the oil price crash here in Louisiana. It was a price fluctuation, and that negatively impacted the local economy.
And I think it's important that we understand the history of that as we move forward here. When it comes to I guess we've got time. Jordan, want to take a break or keep going? Let me keep going here. So when it comes to U.S. oil production now, before we get to the Biden administration, when it comes to U.S. oil production and the market and OPEC and oil not being oil and refineries and gasoline, it's not as simple as it seems because oil is not all oil, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So we have, oil production here in the United States is a different quality than the oil production in other parts of the world. It's got different kind of technical, characteristics. And so the refineries, both here in the United States and globally, will respond to the kind of supply that's out there. And so they'll make, literally these technical changes to the refineries that allow them to take in different types of oil. But in the short run, if you have a big fluctuation, that can be hard to adjust. But in the long run, you can kind of make these adjustments.
So when it comes to the United States being self-dependent when it comes to drilling and oil, and the price of oil and then eventually gasoline, how independent are we when it comes to that, and how dependent are we when it comes to OPEC, and can they open or close the proverbial spigot whenever they want to influence the supply and price of oil and gas?
So today, I think we are less susceptible to these kind of international price shocks that we see. And you could have the example of OPEC. Mm-hmm. The other example, of course, when Russia invaded Ukraine and we saw what happened to markets after that. Because the United States today produces record levels of oil, record levels of natural gas. We're a net exporter of all these products to the world. And so whenever you have a price shock that happens, such as OPEC making a decision, a geopolitical event, such as in the Middle East or Russia, it will impact that international price. And it certainly does impact us here, but I think less so than it might have in the 1970s or the 1980s. Or even the 1990s when you had U.S. oil production was declining over that time period.
And also when it comes to capital expenditures or federal preparation, the actual engineering of this, there is some preparation involved. And given fluctuation, you don't just turn on a valve when you decide to go drilling for oil. It goes to leasing, and we'll get back to that after the commercial break in the Biden administration and the steps that are involved in drilling for oil. It can't be done overnight. That's an accurate statement, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And especially with offshore, which we're about to talk about, you're talking a decade lead time between the initial process and actually producing oil.
All right, let's get back. Let's take a break. We come back. We'll pick it up at shale. And I appreciate you tolerating this fool gladly, because I can hear it in your voice, Greg. You're like, yeah, but we don't know that. That's what I'm trying to get at. I'm trying to educate myself and the audience here, because you and the people in the industry know that, but I think a lot of people don't. So thanks for suffering this fool gladly. 9:21 more with Greg Upton, director of LSU Center for Energy Studies. When we come back, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Greg Upton, our guest, director of LSU Center for Energy Studies, talking about the Biden administration, what they're trying to do with banning drilling in most federal waters. Let me step away from fracking for a moment and get to this, Greg, because President Biden, take me through his administration and the history of his administration with oil and gas, because there's no, I doubt in my mind that he's not a fan of oil and gas. He did what he could to do away with exploration, but then he kind of backed off on it when he realized he couldn't. Tell me about his last 4 years in office, the Biden administration, as it relates to oil and gas exploration, specifically Louisiana.
Sure. So one of the first actions that President Biden took when he took office was his executive order on climate change. And part of that executive order, as you and I, of course, talked about multiple times over that time period, was the discontinuing of offshore leasing while a comprehensive review of these leasing practices was conducted. Immediately, states such as Louisiana sued the federal government. This kind of went through the courts. At the same time, we had the Inflation Reduction Act that was being negotiated. Eventually, all this kind of worked through the system. The offshore leasing continued, and with the Inflation Reduction Act, offshore leasing was continued through that as well, moving forward. Some in the industry, of course, have critiqued the Biden administration of not only providing uncertainty to the industry by taking these actions, but also that the leasing itself has been at a slower clip than you might have had under a Trump administration, for instance. So this has kind of been a consistent policy of the Biden administration. So, of course, now you have the Trump administration that's going to be coming into office here in the next few weeks. And the Trump administration is already talking about and talked about on the campaign trail, really unleashing this U.S. energy production. And so the kind of game plan, according to the Trump administration and a lot of those in Congress that we've interacted with, are saying that we really want to enter this era of unleashing supply, and that, of course, includes offshore leasing and leasing on state lands and water bottoms. So what we saw this last week is President Biden has come in and via these two memoranda has stated that all of these areas, and it's in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, the East Coast, the West Coast, up to Alaska, that the federal government is not going to move forward with leasing in some of these areas. And so kind of the legal implications of that, I'm not quite sure from a legal standpoint how that's going to persist into the next administration. But the idea is to make it more difficult for the next administration to open up these new areas to leasing in order to, of course, restrict the supply of those products.
So if the Biden order goes away and if President Trump gets his way and we drill, baby, drill, what does that mean for the oil supply for the United States? What does it mean for the economy of the Louisiana, for the economy of the United States, gas prices, all that stuff, Greg?
So if you expand oil and gas production, this is going to lead to an increase in supply that can have positive effects on consumers, because if you increase the supply of any good or service, that's going to put downward pressure on the price. The other thing it does is it will, of course, impact the people that are within those industries, right, that you have more oil and gas production, and therefore you've got more jobs needed to support those things. It also impacts us here in Louisiana because we take this energy and we use it as feedstocks and to produce lots of products. So not only are we very energy-intensive manufacturing here, so we use the energy itself, but we also take those hydrocarbons to produce stuff like liquid fuels, chemicals, plastics, fertilizers, and then we ship those products all over the world. And so, you and I have talked about, we've seen a decade of increase in employment in those kind of manufacturing sectors that has been made possible because of the availability of those hydrocarbons. The kind of flip side of that, and I think is the Biden administration's concern, at least at the beginning of this being part of a climate change executive order that initially started all of this, of course, is what's going to be the impact of that on emissions. And so some on that side of the aisle say that this is going to increase global emissions and therefore perhaps the economic benefits are not worth those emissions, which can, of course, have negative impacts on people.
How good could a Trump administration be for Louisiana and offshore drilling in the oil industry?
So I think that there's likely to be easier moving forward with offshore leasing. So in terms of direction, I think that that's going to be good for that industry. In terms of the magnitude of the effect, it's not really clear how large of an effect it will have. And so the Biden administration has argued that, look, we're continuing with leasing. We're continuing with leasing the most productive areas. They argue that they haven't stopped production from these areas that have been leased. And so, how much of an impact that it'll have is kind of uncertain. But in terms of the direction of impacting that industry, of course, a Trump administration policy is going to be preferred by that industry. The other point I'll make, and this is putting on my economist hat of the short run and the long run, but the short-term impacts are probably quite muted. Especially because of, like you and I talked about before the break, of the time period for which it takes to bring to go from leasing all the way to the point of production.
Before we let you go, going back to not just the energy issues, but when it comes to the plastics, et cetera, that come from oil and gas exploration, for those that tend to panic when they see something like this, oil and gas is not going anywhere, anytime in the foreseeable future at all, is it?
I don't think so. I mean, you look at any of these, the World Energy Outlook, you look at the U.S. Energy Outlook. I mean, pretty much any outlook you look at globally has oil and gas being a significant part of our energy mix and the feedstocks for these other products that we're talking about well into the next century. So I think that we're going to have oil and gas for a very long time.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate your time and your insight and your patience as always. Greg Upton, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Jeff Nowak about a different type of black and gold, the Saints, and 2024 season, players looking ahead to 2025, and getting better. 9:34, 26 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:40, 20 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our friend Jeff Nowak, Saints sideline reporter. Happy New Year, Jeff. How you?
I'm doing good. Just adjusting to the off-season schedule right now. It's always a weird transition.
Yeah, I want to mention this. I mentioned earlier that the Pelicans had their NOLA shirts out, and the Saints have one out as well, and Jeff posted a link where you can buy it. Proceeds go to the Saints shirts go to the GNO Foundation's New Year's Day Tragedy Fund. I think the Pelican shirts go to the United Way of Southeast Louisiana. I might have that wrong. Either way, the money's going to a good source. So go to, I reposted it at TTuckerWWL. You can follow Jeff Nowak at JEFF_NOWAK and see what he's got up there for you. Yeah, you know what I was wondering, Jeff? I thought it'd be a good place to start with at the beginning of the season. Well, let me take a step back. Let's talk with the latest news, which is head coaches. And what are you hearing about? First of all, Darren Rizzi has not been let go, has he?
No, and he won't be. That's not really how this works. He's going to be involved in the head coaching interviews, right? He's going to be interviewing for the job. Sounds like that's going to happen at some point next week. It's an interesting scenario because for coaches that are under contract, so coaches that are, say, Aaron Glenn on the Lions, for example, he can actually do virtual interviews this week because they're on a bye, but most other coaches aren't going to be able to do that. If they're in the playoffs, if they're eliminated, you can do virtual interviews. You can't do in-person interviews with anyone under contract until January 20th, which is after the divisional round. But then a guy like Mike Vrabel, for example, who is not coaching this year. He took a year off. Mm-hmm. He can be interviewed at any point. Like, for example, the Jets interviewed Rex Ryan, which is kind of a funny subplot because he is a former Jets coach. The Jets also requested an interview with Darren Rizzi, which they can do because Rizzi is not a full-fledged head coach. In most instances, you could not request someone else's head coach to interview for your head coaching job, but in this case, it would be a promotion because of the interim tag. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on, but no, Rizzi, I think he's going to be a legitimate candidate for this job, and I think in a lot of instances, you look at it, you say, okay, you want to move on, you want to change. What he would say in that instance is, I can be the change guy. You watch what he's done and what he did immediately upon taking the job. He changed as much as you probably could in midstream, but there was a lot of, the way he put it, was like, it wasn't a blank canvas. Like, there was already a lot of painting on that canvas. I could paint on it and try to turn it into something else, but I couldn't start from scratch. And if I got to start from scratch, it would look a lot different. So there's a lot of that, but no, there's going to be a wide net cast. There's going to be a lot of names. I think we already have something like 10 that the Saints have requested to interview. So guys like Aaron Glenn, Anthony Weaver is the Dolphins defensive coordinator, Kellen Moore, who's the Eagles offensive coordinator, Joe Brady, who's the Eagles offensive coordinator. So yeah, there'll be a lot of names thrown in the hat here as we go forward.
Now let me get to my question about players that you were watching before and at the end of the season. I'm thinking Kool-Aid McKinstry. I'm thinking the right tackle whose name escapes me right now.
Swagger. Yeah.
No,
I'm sorry,
the Penning. Right side. Penning. You're right. Trevor Penning, yep. Etc. Go about that. Go and talk about that, if you will.
In what way?
Just about in terms of preseason expectations, who maybe surprised you, who disappointed you, who showed improvement throughout the season.
Yeah, it's tough. You kind of have to step back from the project and kind of look at the whole thing as the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. The frustrating injury at the end of the season was Foster Moreau, who I thought had one of the better seasons for guys who maybe performed above expectations, and then final drive of the final game has a pretty nasty-looking knee injury, so he's going to have to deal with that. I know they hadn't, as of Monday, they hadn't figured out whether it had to be surgically remediated or if he could rehab without surgery. So that's going to be something, but it's got to be frustrating just because now his whole offseason is going to be rehab, and that's the bummer for him. But I thought he had a really strong season. A guy like Fuaga, you know, I think whenever you go to a rookie left tackle, regardless of where they're drafted, there's going to be questions about whether they can handle it, whether they can hack it. I think he did. I think he had rookie moments. There were rough games baked in there. But I think you get to the end of the season and you feel like, hey, we have our left tackle of the future. And that's an important position. There's several positions on the roster that if you don't have it, you're in trouble. You know, whether it's quarterback, whether it's left tackle, whether it's, you know, you need outside corners that you can trust, stuff like that. Left tackle is definitely one of those positions that when you have it, you feel a lot better about the whole picture, not just that position. So I feel good about that. You know, Trevor Penning, I still feel like you could upgrade at right tackle, but he has been serviceable. So, you know, I don't see this as a draft you go into. Like last year, I went into it saying, like, I don't want to draft for need, but I kind of feel like I have to draft for need because I'm not sure if I have either tackle. And so you ended up with Fuaga. I don't feel like you're going into the draft this year with that in mind. So in that sense, I think that the tackle positions were positive. You know, outside corner is tough. I'm not really sure what to make. I'm going to have to go back and kind of look at, you know, some of these games for Kool-Aid and Alante down the stretch and assess personally. I don't think either guy did anything that like kind of blows your mind and says, oh, this is the guy, this is our future at outside corner. But they're both young players. They're both still learning. Kool-Aid is a rookie. I don't think you ever hoped that you would have to get as much run for him as you did. You're going to have to make a decision on Paulson and Debo, but you know, it's going to be all about development for them. And it's also going to be about, when we talk about the coaching search, you know, you're not only hiring a new head coach, you're going to have to make decisions on what you want your defense to be. This has been a very, like, kind of static defensive scheme for a long time, especially on the outside. You're erring toward bigger bodied, physical corners who can play, get up there and play man, jam guys at the line. Who's to say the next defense you bring in, whether it's a defensive head coach or a new defensive coordinator, wants to operate the same way? What if he wants to shift to a more zone heavy scheme and suddenly you're looking for different archetypes at those positions? Those are a lot of the questions you're going to have to answer. But I think they're both quality players. The question is whether either is kind of an outside CB1. And I'm not sure if that's true at this point. Otherwise, you know, it's been a frustrating year. I don't think there's been a ton of guys that have really kind of performed above expectations on this roster. If there were, I think we'd be having a different conversation. The defensive side of the ball has been frustrating. The offensive side of the ball has been mostly hurt. You know, the two guys on offense that I look at and say, hey, okay, I wouldn't mind bringing these guys back, and that wasn't the case at the beginning of the season because neither was here, is MBS and Marquez Valdes-Scantling and Dante Pettis. Both guys, I thought, you know, showed up midseason, had some really nice moments. Dante Pettis got a touchdown against the Bucs. He's been really valuable in the return game. We'll see whether they maybe take some of that weight off Rashid Shaheed going into next season. Obviously, he's going to be coming back from that knee injury. You don't want to overload him. So maybe he's a guy that you can get some value out of there. And then MBS has obviously been a deep threat we've seen this year. You know, when you rely on kind of these slighter frame receivers, injuries can be a problem. And he's a guy who, you know, has that, you know, deep ball upside, has legit size at 6'4", so he could be a valuable piece for you too. So, you know, those are probably the names that come to mind.
Text comes in about asking about any other members of the Saints staff that would be considered as head coaching candidates. Drew Brees saying, I think that he would consider Clint Kubiak. That's on social media. What is the word on that, Jeff, as far as you know?
I'd be surprised if there are any head coaching interviews from Saints staffers. You know, I mean, maybe Clint. It's always tough to kind of get into that coaching conversation when you have such a frustrating season, when you have all these injuries, and you didn't really get to display what you probably could have. I mean, if you go back to week two, you look some of the tweets after week two, the biggest conversation was, man, it's going to be a one and done for Clint Kubiak. The Saints are the best offense in football. He's going to be on the short list. And that kind of went away during that 7-game losing streak. I don't know. I can't really think of anyone off the top of my head that would just jump out as head coach material right now. Rizzi would be that guy, and he is going to get interviewed for the Jets. We'll see if he gets any interviews for any other jobs. I'd be interested to see if you know, maybe Kai Harley or Jeff Ireland emerge in. I know that someone fired their GM yesterday. I can't recall who it was. Maybe it wasn't the Raiders. Titans. It was the Titans who fired their GM. So maybe Jeff Ireland or Kai Harley end up in the interviews for that open GM slot. We'll have to see. But I don't anticipate right now having conversations about a bunch of people interviewing for head coaching jobs.
I got to get to Derek Carr and the differences between restructuring and pay cut and Saints salary cap challenges and all that.
Yeah, the Derek Carr discourse is really, I don't know, it's frustrating because I feel like a lot of people are just sitting around waiting for Derek to say anything so they can get mad about it. And basically all he said this week, and he was talking one-on-one with Kat Terrell, ESPN reporter, and he told her, he's like, I'm not interested in taking a pay cut. Everyone freaked out about that. He's like, oh, man, all these people are like, I would totally take a pay cut for my workplace.
But wait, hang on a second. Really? Would you?
No,
honestly,
no,
would anybody?
No.
Honestly,
come on.
Who would be excited about taking a pay cut? Come on.
Exactly. That's what drives me nuts is people go on Twitter, like, I can't believe you're so selfish. Like, really? Do you go into work and be like, here, take the money back. I don't want it. Take it back. Hire somebody else. No, that's just not how it works. So I don't know. It's just, you know, you got to ask the question. He answered it. The restructure part of it, I don't even know if Derek Carr completely understands the restructure part of it, because it's the thing that's written into Saints contracts that the team can execute simple restructures without any approval from the player. It doesn't really affect their compensation. It just affects how it's paid out. So, you know, it's just something they do. That's the question with Derek Carr is, do you eat the cap hit this year and move on because you're just not in a position to contend right now? And it doesn't make sense to pay your quarterback $40 million when you're not in a position to contend, or do you restructure his contract and clean up everything around him so that in 2026 and beyond, you're in a better situation independently of the quarterback? Because the problem with cutting the quarterback and eating the cap hit would be, okay, well, I have to restructure basically everybody else. And there's a lot of contracts on my ledger right now that I don't really want to restructure. Because you got a bunch of guys over 30 in Tyron Matthew, DeMario Davis, Cam Jordan, Taysom Hill, Alvin Kamara. It's like, I don't want to restructure those contracts either and tie myself to those guys for multiple seasons. So that's the conversation as it pertains to Derek. And I think is really not going to be a definitive answer to that conversation, to that question, until you hire a coach and you find out, what does that coach want, right? If the head coach you bring in says, hey, I like Clint Kubiak, I like the scheme that we rolled out there, and I think if we're healthy, we can get some things done, let's run it back with Derek. Then that kind of makes your decision for you. If the new head coach comes in and says, I don't really want to go with Derek, I want to go with a young guy, I want to reset so that we can kind of get this thing rolling in the right direction, then that makes your decision that way. So, you know, I think we're a few weeks away from really having anything, any paths in front of us that you could even take as it pertains to Derek and his contract.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate your time and insights as always. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Follow him on at @JEFF_NOWAK. And of course, he and Steve Geller do the Inside the Black and Gold podcast, 9:53, 7 till 10. We'll come back, find out what Newell Norman's got planned for us today here on WWL.